Whoops, that's not what I wanted. All right. Good morning. It is about 5 after 10 on Thursday, August 18th. My name is Julie Fedorchak. I'm chair of the commission. We are gathered for a work session on the MDU rate increase request, case number PU-22-194. This is for the electric rates. The only opening comments I have are just to kind of provide the stage. So this is a discussion with us and our advisory staff to talk through some of the key issues in the rate case and any other issues that we would like to explore, I think would have merit in the advocacy exploring in more detail. So we've got, I think, an hour and a half scheduled, or just an hour. But yeah, we can use however much or little of that as we need. So I don't have any more opening comments. Commissioner Christman, do you?
I don't really either. I'll let advisory staff go ahead, and they'll probably, I think, summarize in a more timely manner than I would, and then I'll just add on if there's something that I want to.
Okay, very good. And then since this is your portfolio, Sherry, I'll pass it over to you, and you can give your opening comments, kick it over to staff, run that, do it however you'd like. So,
okay. Well, good morning. I look forward to hearing from the advisory staff. I know, Adam, you have done a lot of work, so I'm going to hold off on any opening comments and just turn it over to you to provide us an overview.
All right. Thank you, commissioners. To get started, on May 16th, 2022, MDU filed an application to increase their electric rates for North Dakota customers. They filed for a revenue increase of approximately $25.4 million, or approximately 12.3% over current rates, or over current revenue, rather. The proposed allocation of revenue to residential rate class is 17.3%, which is equivalent to a $14.94 per month increase to the average residential bill using 800 kilowatt hours per month. This includes a $6.39 per month increase in the basic service charge. Their class of cost study has indicated that they want to move the residential class closer to parity. So, in other words, closer to cost versus revenue. Currently, it is at 0.73. So that basically says residential class is covering about 73% of the cost of revenue, and they're moving that up to 0.88. So to give you a background on the interveners in this case, AARP has intervened, as well as Walmart and Marathon Petroleum. So if you look at, so now I'll probably go over the main drivers here.
Is that just strictly on the representing themselves, or because there's four of those very large use customers within MDU, right? Are they representing all four or just themselves?
Just themselves. So now I'll go over some of the main drivers, and you can probably go back and probably take a look at attachment 2 as we go through this. So you'll notice on the bottom the total increase ties to the $25.4 million that has been requested. The main drivers here are first, if you take a look at the addition of, I'll say, Heskett Unit 4, you've got approximately $5.6 million increase, and that is related to the $4.2 million of rate base increase that's already been incurred on the first line, and then you add on that to the increase in depreciation of the $1.1 million that you'll see in the income statement increases. So they've requested a $5.6 million increase.
And can I just interrupt? This is a trivial one, but I just don't like it when the ends don't meet. Even if we round those two up, that's $5.3 million, and then your memory is at $5.6.
Is it $5.3? That could be taxes. Okay. So it would be in the tax line. So now what we're looking at is...
Okay, a quick question on the Haskett. How is that unit being recovered today? Is it in the generation rider?
The Haskett Unit 4 is in, let's see, that would be in...
Or is it not?
Well, it's not
in
service yet. So it's not in service. So that's what we're here discussing. It is not in rate base currently. So it's expected to go into
service.
Yeah, I'm trying to find that information. Oh, the in-service date is April 2023.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. So will we be, is this assuming that these rates aren't finalized before it's in service? Or does it not have to be in service before they start collecting rates?
So say that again.
Is this assuming that we won't approve these rates before it's in service, or does it need to be in service before they start collecting the
It needs to
rates?
Be, yeah, so it would need to be in service. So right now, take a step back, the test year is 2023. So,
okay.
And it is going to be in service in April 2023. So they have requests, and in their request, they have assumed for purposes of rate base and depreciation that it would be in service for the full year of 2023. And the rationale there is that way they wouldn't have to come back for another rate case.
Okay.
Or at least because it's such a lumpy investment, right?
Yeah.
That... but that's maybe one thing to consider, because if it had already been in service, for the other units, what they do is they take the beginning and ending balance and divide it by two, so they take kind of a midpoint.
Okay. And is Haskett 3 impacted by this case? Are we moving that from the generation rider to rate base, or have we
already
done
that? Would be Haskett 1 and 2. Haskett 1 and 2
are closing, aren't they?
Yeah, they're closing.
Mm-hmm. And then 3.
So Lewis and Clark, Unit 1, and Haskett 1 and 2 are moving to the generation rider.
Oh, to be collected?
Yeah, to be recovered. Because that's another part of that.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, how long do we want to amortize their decommissioning costs in early retirement?
And then third, Haskett 3, how is that currently handled?
Haskett 3, I believe that, I'd have
to
look.
I feel like that's in the generation rider, right?
Is that in the generation rider?
Well, I was going to say, is that currently in base rates already?
Well, I think that might be in base rates.
In 2016.
Is that a 2016?
I'd have to double check.
Yeah. I'd have to double check, too.
Okay.
I would want to say off the cuff.
Okay. All right. Sorry, Adam. You can continue on.
Okay, so then what else we have here? We have an increase in labor expense of $5.5 million. And you could kind of take a look. I put attachment 3 in there for you to take, for you to look and just to see, you know, the large variance. What they've done is they've adjusted out the headcount for Heskett and Lewis and Clark that is subject to early retirement. And then compared that to the 2023 test year. And you'll notice the $4 million variance there for your regular labor. And that's where most of the increase in labor expense is found. This MD explains this by they want to replace approximately 13 customer service positions that they state turned over in 2022 and add 7 positions and 2 promotions related to the addition of what their distribution outage management system.
And we're going to need more explanation than what we've got, not that.
Their outage management system is, from what I understand, is more of a manual pencil and paper method. So if we want to be in compliance with the IEEE standards that our rules have been made upon and based upon, they need to define major event days properly. So in other words, if they have an outage on their distribution system, and that impacts an area or a township, then they need to have a standard definition for what a major event day is, and that is what they propose to add. That's their rationale for adding headcount and the technology systems behind that outage management system. They also have an updated depreciation study, so that accounts for $4.6 million. And you'll notice that is one under the increase in depreciation under the income statement increases.
So when it comes to these depreciation studies, can you guys provide some context for where are there potential discrepancies in terms of what might be reasonable and what might be unreasonable? You know, like, where's the room for us to engage in the depreciation study area? Are those hard science, or is that something that is kind of an art?
That's statistics.
That's what?
That's statistics. So those are statistical models.
I don't know whether that makes it a science or an art.
There are different depreciation methods, though, Adam, right?
Like, there are different ways to analyze them.
Right. So there's, and sometimes, for example, a utility will come forward and you move from one type of depreciation to a different application. They'll apply a different form of depreciation, right? And that can substantially change, I guess, the depreciation model, correct?
In terms of a method?
Yes.
I would say it's, in my understanding, it's more of a like an analytical framework with how they take a look at, okay, so what is the useful life, right? Is it 5 years? Is it 10 years, right? So they're adjusting estimates then. Also, they're looking at decommissioning, right? Like how much decommissioning costs will they have at the end, you know, to clean up a plant, for instance. Or also, what's driving this, for instance, is they've had about $1.9 million in additional environmental upgrades that they claim at the Big Stone plant, as well as $2.8 million related to changing depreciation rates on their distribution system. So I think that, we'd want to take a look at those estimates and how they were derived.
I would agree. Okay, but then it, how does that feed into the formula or the methodology that's used for the depreciation? Like, what are they, when you say there's a new depreciation study, mm-hmm. what is this study? And is it just an update on an existing study because you've got new things that you need to include, or give me more context for what's all included in the depreciation analysis and where there might be room for us to question or disagree with what they're claiming here.
Maybe you talk about how the depreciation, and I apologize, I started to reach into it, I just ran out of time, so I didn't get to dig in as deep into the depreciation as I would have hoped to, but I will shortly. Maybe discuss the changes that we would see within the depreciation study, and maybe the methodology, if there is any sort of change in methodology that they're requesting. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I have not had a chance to dig into the depreciation study at all, you know, very much as well.
But those would be things we could look at and question.
Yeah,
and right. I would assume that the contractors we've hired would be doing that.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
That advocacy would be digging into the depreciation too.
Right.
Depreciation studies is something that advocacy does always do an evaluation of.
And I think the last depreciation study they did was prior to our 2016 depreciation, prior to our 2016 rate case.
Okay. I would assume they update it for rate cases. So
yeah, they try to align, but they also operate in different jurisdictions, so sometimes it doesn't always align.
Okay.
So then, let's see here. They've also.
So how does that work then with the different jurisdictions? If some commission is insistent on an adjustment in something, then what happens with the others? I mean, the company-wide, they have to be on the same depreciation schedule, don't they?
Right. Jack is shaking his head. Jack's correct. In this case, prior to 26, it's my understanding that they had a depreciation study done in Montana. And in that, as part of the settlement negotiation, they came to an agreement on a rate. And that subsequently they came to North Dakota, and just to avoid the headache that Commissioner Chrisman is talking about, they decided to keep our rates consistent with Montana's rates.
What you're speaking of is jurisdictional alignment issues, and they tend to align a lot of times, especially I think this commission has been generally fairly constructive towards the regulatory alignment, but there is no absolute requirement for there to be perfect regulatory alignment.
And I've seen here the increase in taxes. Did taxes just go up higher?
No, that relates to, you know, when you add something in rate base, since we'd be recovering that.
I know, but didn't Congress just and the President just sign a pretty sizable increase in corporate tax, and does that affect MDU, and how will that be addressed in this rate case?
Yeah, I guess I've been following, the latest legislation federal taxes.
Did you look at the drivers of the taxes, for example? In some of the rate cases, we will frequently see an increase in property tax as a result in an increase in the tax rates, or is...
Oh, for property tax?
Or, is that one of the aspects, or are there... Did you look through the breakdowns of these?
Oh, well, property tax, let's see. So property tax would be in there. I forget what... They did have an increase in property tax. I forget in what property, but there was one of their plants that they called out that was an increase in property tax.
So that contributed to this increase in taxes.
Right, yep. I was thinking that was a separate line. But I think I rolled up property tax to that line.
One of the other things we probably need to pursue, and I'm assuming that advocacy will be talking to the company about it also, is the tax impacts of this latest, what's it called, the IRA or whatever bill that was passed. I'm losing track of where it was included, but I believe it was included in that IRA.
The Inflation Reduction Act?
Yes.
Okay. That was signed, yeah.
So we probably, that probably isn't just an MDU issue either. And maybe it doesn't affect utilities.
The last cut certainly did.
And let's see, and then also
not because we were assured that it wouldn't impact lower and middle class people. So.
True. Plus, I've read that new bill is going to save people. Like, energy costs are going to go down by like 5 or 10% as a result of this. So
pretty phenomenal.
God, they are miracle workers.
Also, right now, the return on equity is 9.65%. They proposed to increase that to about 10.5%. I think just back of the envelope, that's maybe about $950,000 impact.
What was the last part you said?
The ROE, the return on equity, increased from 9.65% to 10.5%.
You said something more about it.
Yeah, and I think back of the envelope, I think that's about $950,000 impact.
Oh, okay. The revenue requirement.
It'll take quite a bit of convincing to get me there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also like more explanation. I don't know, in I guess recent years I've been less satisfied in my mind about the common equity ratios. And I don't know how we compare to other jurisdictions or when we look at the ROEs that these companies are at, I don't know that that's necessarily the best source of their capital.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to look at both those.
Okay. The common equity ratio as well as?
As well as the ROE.
ROE, okay.
But you said that the 9.65 to 10.5. would be about a $950,000?
Yeah, I'll have to check that number.
All right.
Okay, so let's see. It's, so now in a prior case, the commission authorized deferred accounting treatment for the early retirement of Lewis and Clark 1 and Heskett 1 and 2. So what MBU's estimated that currently they're collecting in rates $21.6 million in revenue requirement.
Where are you reading from? What page are you on?
Oh, so, I'm on page 2. I think even though I have with the retirement of, cross retirement of, and it's just that's what the based on current rates, mm-hmm. that's what they're collecting is $21.6 million. So what they've done is, you know, at first they would, you know, they estimate, okay, well, what do we need to, what do they need in terms of when they accelerate their depreciation? You know that's going to be a cost, as well as the incremental decommissioning costs that they identified. And those are the two main components on that. So the question is, how do, you know, what length do we extinguish that? So,
you know, how long we amortize that out?
How long?
I guess just for personal clarification, Adam, so we did approve the deferred accounting treatment for this, but right. the deferred accounting does not allow them recovery. So oh, they're having recovery for that. So they're currently, we also approved allow on the interim recovery through the generation rider. Is that right?
Yeah, that's where it'll be recovered.
It will be, or it is being?
It will be.
Okay.
Yeah, right. It will be.
So we said, go ahead and do the deferred accounting.
Right.
Start that.
Yep.
We'll determine what's prudent in the next rate case, basically, which is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
What they can recover, what we agree to them recovering for.
Right.
That.
So we have a pretty good idea on their depreciation, right? Because that's based on a schedule. And then what we'll have to do is we'll have to take a look at their decommissioning, right? To see if those actual costs materialize, and then we could take a look at those costs as well as their employee-related costs, and how much how many employees were laid off, and then what kind of retraining, if they chose to retrain some of the employees, that would be a benefit to a ratepayer. So we would have to take a look at that. We'd have to take a look at those costs.
Are those employee costs in this, or are they in the other?
Well,
there's some lines in here somewhere about the personnel. And
so that those would be separate. So you know, this is
just about the physical structure, isn't it?
Well, in terms of the decommissioning, like I think it's like, I don't know, it's like 8. I was on a case, and I don't even know if I was here. They had deferred accounting for what it took to what it takes to decommission it, right? You know, at the time, they probably offer severance packages, right? So that would be included in this, and then
costs. The decommissioning costs.
To closure costs.
Okay.
When I say decommissioning, I mean all in decommissioning,
sure.
Because there's going to be severance costs. There's going to be the accelerated depreciation, which is just on timing, right? Because they initially had a schedule that was much further out, but now since they've already been retired, they had to take all those dollars and basically push them into the present, you can say. So that's going to be a chunk that would have ordinarily have been retired if they had been used and useful. But now they're now essentially, a stranded cost that has to be recoverable,
sure.
for depreciation in the future that wasn't used and useful.
But that would all be in the generation rider.
That would all be recovered in the generation rider. Right?
Okay.
Yep.
That's where it would be recovered.
Yep.
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 But we're deciding what's reasonable for those costs here in this case.
Yes, we are. Yeah, right.
And then the impact of extending it from 2025 to 2031?
Yep. Yeah. So, provide a little more information. So the soonest that they can retire, if they took that entire $21.6 million, which is what they're currently collecting in rates, and use that to extinguish or amortize, to said differently, that big bucket of dollars, which is like maybe $80 million, let's say, then the soonest that they could retire that would be in 2025. and they, but that would be a big initial hit to ratepayers. So what they've proposed then is to extend that rather than 21.6 million, they'll reduce that by extending that amortization period out to 2031, which is a 10-year period amortization. And that amount would be 7.8 million that they would subsequently put in the generation rider that we could then track and true up.
And do we know how much more just the total amount is going to cost the ratepayers by spreading it out as opposed to paying it early?
We could calculate that, yeah. You know, we could,
I don't know where 2030, I get the point of doing it,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, so if 2031's improvement, why not 2037? You know, I don't know how, where the best spot is in there, and I think that that should be discussed.
On your chart here, Adam, on attachment 2, we've got the net of the Lewis and Clark Heskett 1 and 2 early retirement changes being a net savings, right?
Right.
$13 million.
Yep.
$13.8 million. Mm-hmm. And that's this LNC and Heskett savings, where does that number come from, the 21.6?
So that would come from whatever they would have in their revenue requirement. So, you know, depreciation, labor, whatever's associated with running that plant.
I see.
And
okay.
There could be, some shared facilities in there since Heskett, there's Heskett 3 and then Heskett 4. And then, so there's kind of some judgment call in that as well.
I see. And then minus the 7 in amortization. So the net is 13. Then how do all these columns, how does this all add up? So you've got the rate base increase total of 13.7. And then we've got the 25.3 million minus the 13 from the Heskett early retirement. And then the total. So I'm not catching. Following how you've got these different totals calculated here.
Okay. Let's see here.
I think she's got the same question that I had.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that explanation?
Right. So.
No, he's got that. Like the 13, the 25, and the 25.
Yeah.
They weren't coming up to me, and Adam pointed out that
there's taxes.
Well, okay.
Separate, maybe.
Yeah, these categories weren't. There's one of them that's different than the ones listed in the memo.
Make sure that's right here.
Well, maybe just explain what are these each of these totals here, and maybe they don't tie together. Maybe that's my problem.
Okay.
So the total, 13.7 million, that's all
That's all the rate base. That's the total for the rate base.
All the increases in the rate base.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Except for in your memo, you said the rate base additions are 9.6 million. And the difference is the 4.2 million for Heskett. In your memo, you categorized with the Heskett depreciation down below into. The addition of Heskett 4 to rate base of 5.6 million.
Right.
That really helped me when you pointed that out.
The 4.2 million in rate base increase for Heskett 2, you'll notice up there, if you add that to the depreciation of 1.1 million, you should get right around, and then you add taxes onto that, you get right around 5.6 million.
And by subtracting it out of these rate base increases on the chart, then it matches with the number, the 9.6 that you said of
right
in the memo.
Right, yeah.
How do you get this? What is being added together for the total increase 25.372099 at the bottom of this memo? What is that the net of?
Yeah, let me do some quick math
here. Your total increase number.
Yeah, let me do some quick math here. So what I've done is I've separated this into the rate base increases of 14 million. And then you've got several income statement increases. So you've got the 13.7 million. And then you add that to the...
Wait. 15.7 million is where?
Let me do this real quick here. Yeah, no, that's right. Okay, so... Let me break this down. So we've got a rate base increase of 13.798 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move on to the income statement increases.
Yep.
And those buckets are 2.9 million in lower sales revenue. That's in bold.
Yep.
We've got
yep.
10 million increase in O&M.
Okay, and then you break those down.
You've got a 9.97 million increase in depreciation.
Yep.
And then you've got taxes of 2.5 million. And then, so you add up the 13.798 to the 25.377. And then you take out the 13.8 million. And then you get 25.372.
All right.
So the head, what Commissioner Chrisman was talking about is, you know, where is that 5.6 million? So that is in Heskett Unit 4 for the rate base increase. That's
yep.
already incurred. And then you've got depreciation of 1.1 million.
And some taxes. Okay. In terms of the transmission projects and substation rebuild, the 2.4 million, do we know if that's MISO level or is that? Because then there's a transmission and distribution too. So I guess just, and we can dig into this more later, but how much of this is MISO driven transmission increases?
So the MISO, so one part of this is that the transmission rider as well as the renewable, what do they call it? The renewable rider and the transmission rider, there are no changes to that. So this...
You mean structurally there are no changes to it?
Yeah, there are no changes. In other words, they're not adding dollars to it. In this rate case, it's not a subject to this rate case. So whatever procedure they're going to follow, like they're going to keep on. They're not going to add or subtract anything from either of those two riders.
Seems like it would be normal for if there's projects in them to be moved over out of the rider into rate base. And maybe there aren't. I can't recall, but Thunder Spirit isn't in the rider, or is that already in?
It is that is the normal practice to move things into base rates, but part of the reason why the renewables, for example, are remaining in the rider is due to the changing amortization, the levelization
okay.
of the PTCs that the commission previously approved. So it's a little more simple to leave within the renewable rider, if my recollection is correct.
Yeah, that's correct. Yep.
Got it. And then the
forgot about that.
Renewable and transmission. Same thing on the transmission. It's just easier to track it there. I mean, the MISO stuff probably for sure.
Yeah, the MISO stuff for sure, I would say.
It would be for different reasons as the renewable rider to have it remain there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we can.
That we should dig into the transmission stuff. Sure. I mean, as a category of things to make sure we're.
To maybe if there's a possibility to roll things into base rates.
Well, just to understand what's being collected there and why and. You know, that it's all kosher.
We do have a transmission rider in front of us.
But these projects, whatever's in the 2.4 and 1.9 million.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
This rate case, we should
make sure. Oh, in this case, yeah. Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah. Okay. So how MDU accounts for this is that they've got two buckets. Essentially, they've got like a rebuild or a refurbish, something like that. And these are their blanket buckets, right? In which they know that they've got to go out and, like, if they've got a wood pole and it's a problem, right? They can't really identify that. They just know they have to improve it. Maybe they make it a steel one and, you know, increase longevity to it. So they've got some general buckets that they have. And then they also have a couple, they also can identify very specific projects. So that's, So the transmission projects and substation rebuild of 2.5 million, that represents projects that they've individually identified. And then kind of the catch-all bucket should be in that transmission and distribution of 2 million. Or maybe the line growth and replacement. But the line growth and replacement, maybe you have to add that one too, but you kind of get the idea there.
Are those projects rebuilds like for the year, or is it projected for the next 5 years? Or where they start collecting some of that?
Yeah, so they would collect it over time. So, I don't know how many years, but it kind of depend on structure.
So in this area, you mentioned, you gave your example of the old pole that needs replacing and the line growth and replacement. So I assume your example falls under the replacement side. When we're talking about line growth, we're talking about new growth in a community, new commercial developments, things like that, right?
Yes. I believe my memory is.
One of the things that, you know, it's just, it's hard to justify in the big picture is in looking at your attachment too. Mm-hmm. We have line growth and replacement. And then a few lines later, we have lower sales and revenue. Well, if there's any amount of significant line growth, we shouldn't have much lower sales. And it would seem to me almost that COVID might have increased electric consumption with a lot of people staying at home and keeping their houses cool all day because they're not in the office or something. But I don't know. I'm just thinking anecdotally.
Yeah.
But whatever justification there is, how we can have any significant amount of line growth and yet lower sales.
Right.
They don't seem to correlate.
I think MDU's answer to that would be the lower of a pickup in the Bakken. So, you know, so they maybe are anticipating a lower rebound in the Bakken is their answer to that. So in other words, the five-year average of sales growth from 2021, the future five-year average is what they're forecasting from 2021 through 2026. is 1.06% versus a five-year historic average from 2015 through 2020 of 1.12%. So we should probably understand that a little better.
Mm-hmm. It's a good area to dig into. You can proceed, Adam.
Yeah, with okay, I'm just making some notes and taking a look at where we are here. Also, MDU is moving the Lewis and Clark Rice units that's currently in the generation rider into base rates. And that was part of the last rate case. That was part of an agreement. They're also proposing to add a prepaid pension asset to rate base. And if you recall, in the MDU gas case, we allowed them recovery, we allowed them to place a prepaid pension asset. Essentially, that's when they're making a lot, you know, more contributions. And, you know, they keep on making contributions, and they eventually get, their claim is that they don't get a return on that, so they keep on investing into the pension, and they've put more contributions, essentially, than what their cash the cash contributions,
really what's happening is they've created a capital contribution to the pension fund. It's overpaid on the front end, and so what they're essentially, it creates a regulatory asset, an aspect that they are requesting a return on, which is pretty commonplace, and the commission has actually approved in a previous case as well. So that is something that has been from the commission in the past.
Yeah. Remind me why they do that ahead of time. Are they behind? Or, like, they're contributing more than what their current employees, like their matches for their current employees? Is that what I'm understanding?
I believe it's a, well, they do not have a pension anymore. And so so they're prepaying to pay down the pension, if my recollection is correct. And what happened is, so they were modeling their pension funds, and they believe their contributions that they need to do to cover the amount ended up being over the amount by a notable sum. So essentially they overpaid, which isn't a bad thing, but it just means here's a capital investment that the company has actually provided into this, and normally an item like a capital investment is something that they are allowed a return on, and so in regulatory rate making, you create a regulatory asset, and allowed a return component on that account for that value. And so that's essentially what they're requesting, I believe, unless I'm wrong.
No, you're right. Yeah, it's pension accounting is pretty complicated, but they're contributing more than essentially they're required to. And it's that gap of the level of contributions that they're making are in excess of the liabilities based on forward-looking kind of actuarial guidance.
Right. In short, they're trying to make it whole, but they've over
paid
contribution, contributed. So.
Why wouldn't they pull that out then? Why does it need to stay there? They're going to need it long-term. Like, if there's more in there than what they estimate is needed, why would they keep it there?
Why would they keep it?
In the pension.
Why would they keep overpaying?
So they
notice they're overpaying, I mean...
I don't believe it's a continuous practice. I believe they just did to this point. They over-contributed.
Are they the only ones doing this model of the regulated utilities, or is this how they're all doing their pension funds?
I don't think this is an issue we've addressed in any of the other regulated entities. This is it's been an MDU issue, at least as far as we've done for the rate case reviews. Unless you've seen any of the other Otter Taylor.
Yeah, I haven't dug into that. Yeah, no. The only one that I'm aware of right now, maybe they've already had them. I know this is a big utility issue, about the prepaid and making, you know, contributions in excess of what is absolutely maybe the minimum requirement, but there are rules that govern that and how much they have to pay, and then if they have to prepay, sometimes that's their choice as well.
So the prepay is going to continue on. Not the overpay.
Yeah, the prepaid would be an asset, essentially. Yeah, so that would be, they would earn a return on the asset. So, in other words, you can either put an expense, you could give them expense recovery for the pension, or you could say, okay, we're going to put those pension dollars that they consider what they've prepaid from their contributions onto the books and earn a rate of return on it.
I guess it had slipped my mind. I didn't recall this discussion in the 16. Mm-hmm. But if I'm understanding you right, that they're following they've got their own pension fund, do it differently than everyone else. Perhaps that's something we ought to be kind of evaluating to see if this is a better or poorer model than what other utilities use.
I don't think they're doing this different than any other utility, at least as far as my understanding is. This is just a matter of I guess, pension costs, liabilities, and where it actually landed ultimately. I don't think it was the last electric rate case as well. I think it was actually the gas case where we probably addressed this. Don't hold me to that, but I believe it was a MDU gas case thing. But of course, similar items.
Okay, so then let's see. So then, so then, let's see. And there are a number of items to dig in terms of if we take a look at O&M, the biggest driver there, of course, is labor. So we'll want to take a look at that. The depreciation schedule, or the depreciation study we've already mentioned. Yeah, but I haven't really looked into that much. To see, you know, what kind of time frame and length we want to assume for the amortization of Lewis and Clark and Heskett 1 and 2. The total decommissioning costs and for Lewis and Clark and Heskett to, you know, what is in the revenue requirement of the $21.6 million for the savings? The Heskett 4 cost is capped at a certain number. We cap that at a certain number. It's a couple million dollars below, I believe, the estimate currently. So we'll probably want to take a look at some of the, you know, the costs.
Our cap was less than their estimate, or their estimate is less than our cap?
Currently, right now, in their 8 case, from my understanding, they're a little bit below that. But we'll want to take a look to see if, you know, they have things like contingency involved in that. You know, that'd be a simple one.
Adam, is there anything from the, I guess, from the previous RIA case, besides, I mean, we know we've addressed these pension funds before. Are there any other items that, I guess, stick out to you that we've made a decision previously and that we probably would more than likely be, it would more than likely be a non-controversial item related to here?
Is part of what the last settlement was?
The last what we normally do? Rate increase order, yeah.
The last rate increase or like what we normally look at and disallow?
No. Like not what we normally disallow, but a lot of the issues that have been brought up aside from that pension asset, regulatory asset, are there other things that you've seen that maybe you would anticipate being less controversial due to the fact that we've had a precedent of making a decision on that?
Less controversial.
Like, for example, like the rice units?
Oh, yeah.
That those remain in the generation rider, right. But more than likely they probably did not need to remain in the regeneration rider. That was as part of the settlement, and that probably could have probably already been in the base rates.
Right. I guess we can, none that I can think of really off the top of my head, unless you can think of something.
Yeah, I thought maybe you could run through it if you had some.
Do you think of anything?
I'm just going to run through them.
What's that? Okay, you ran through
them?
Not that I can think of, at least. I'm sure there are some, though.
Is there anything else the commission would like to discuss specifically?
To me, the transmission stuff, I'm curious what these environmental upgrades are at Big Stone. That's a sizable amount of money. Do I need to be reminded about us approving that already through an ADP, or where did that $1.9 million come from on the Big Stone plan? The transmission stuff, I think I already mentioned. I agree with Randy on the ROE. I mean, obviously, the financial markets are in flux.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a challenging thing to work through in this case. What's fair.
Maybe by the time we get to a hearing, it'll seem real reasonable.
Yeah. I know. I looked at it and was like, yikes, but I had that same thought. Like, things are not going in a good direction here.
I don't know. I think we've seen 10 to 10.75 as a return request for about the last 10 years. So
right.
It's been a pretty consistent ask in that range.
Okay. Excuse me. So, those things are the main additional thoughts that jumped out at me, and I'm just curious to explore the depreciation schedule again, and that's a huge additional
piece.
What's driving that?
And I think that may be beneficial to maybe write, I could, or Adam could write a memorandum to give you guys a quick refresher on depreciation. The last time we really dug into that has been a few years ago. So I could probably give you a page or two pretty quick on the overview on the concepts of that.
Sure.
And how that generally applies, and then I'll let you work on applying that generally to the case as you see fit. And there are a lot of capital expenditures, very large ones in this case, and so one thing the commission, I'm sure, will like to be looking at is to the extent that they're absolutely necessary to provide adequate service and reliability, and to the extent that they're not going over and above what is necessary to provide adequate service.
Another thing that I had, most of my list now we've discussed, and either now I understand or now I know you guys are going to be on it. But, and this is sort of similar to what we talked about with extending the amortization out on those plants to 2031. And I said, well, okay, why that particular year? So when we get back to the amount of the rate increase that's applied to residential, and their proposal adjusts that ratio of what residential pays compared to their costs, as I understand it, from 0.73 to 0.88. And I think it's always been the philosophy of this commission for at least recent past that, you know, maybe that had gotten pretty far out of whack and that it needed to be brought closer. But I don't know that I ever had, and I certainly was on board with that. But I don't know that my goal was ever a full one-to-one, though, either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is some justification, you know, having a good living environment for employees and things like that where they can live and afford to be there to be your workers and to be your customers. And so while I think we used to be way low and it needed to get closer to one, I don't think one is necessarily a goal. And so why this amount from 0.73 to 0.88? Is that MDU's understanding of what our goal is and they're moving it all the way in one step? It's not halfways to one. I just don't know why that amount. And so I think there needs to be consideration given whether it should be going to 0.8 or 0.85 or to one. I don't know where it should be. I don't know. I don't have a justification for this amount.
I think they actually did provide a notable amount of justification for the move in the class cost of service testimony. I was more oriented towards the numbers and looking at what it was rather than the actual reasoning for it when I was had a little bit of time to sit down and review it all. But we could definitely provide just more context to that if you'd like.
Okay, and perhaps it is in there. I certainly have not read every word yet.
Sure.
All right.
Okay. One more thing I'd like to talk about. What do you expect or anticipate now? So you've gotten some thoughts from us, and I don't know where we're at with consultants or anything, but what's the time frame of this? As I would look at this, we're going to be in kind of an awkward situation. I really hate it when we have rate cases during the legislative session. They don't understand the complexity of a rate case, and that when they schedule a hearing on a bill that impacts us greatly or on our budget, we don't get to just say, well, we have all these consultants and the company's all here. We're busy that day. No, they expect us down there. And so are we going to be at a point of having a hearing already in November or December? That seems awful fast to me. Or am I worrying about this too much that it won't be till after the session or at crossover time or something? Or what's your guesstimate of time frames on this?
I think if we remain with a normal procedural schedule, we'd probably be smack dab in which hasn't been set yet, but a normal procedural schedule would put us in the middle of session. But, I mean, there's always flexibility to work around to what works for us as well. And we've accommodated in the past as well where maybe one commission had to sneak out and give testimony then join back in.
I think we looked at this the last time we talked about this, and you kind of expressed those same concerns, Randy, and I thought it was somewhat reasonable that we might be able to hit this crossover time period for hearings. So I guess that might be, like, the best option. The second best option would be we do it at a time, you know, like, where we think it's the least likely to have conflicts. And then we just are prepared to do, as Jack said, flip out for an hour for a hearing or whatever.
Well, if it can't be by, like, that first week of the session, when, you know, the first week or so is not likely that they have our budget or any controversial bills.
Sure.
You know, just keep in mind, even that first few days after crossover is sort of like the beginning of the session.
Pretty, yeah.
Pretty quiet, so. I guess it's just something to keep in mind.
I'm sure we'll be able to find something that works for us in a fairly agreeable manner.
Okay. Anything else?
No, Randy had, I was going to do ask you for an overview kind of a timeline, so we're all on the same page there. But I want to thank you guys for your study. I know there's a lot of work to be done yet on this case. We raised some good points on where we need to dig in and get further clarification. So thank you for your work. If there's nothing else, I have nothing else as a portfolio.
Okay.
If I may, sure, could we just run through the things that we'd anticipate you guys would like to have looked at? You know, there's the Inflation Reduction Act and how that may be applied or impacting rates. Hypothetically, if there is some sort of impact, we may need sort of supplemental filing from the company as well as advocacy staff on that. Commissioner Christman wanted an explanation on common equity values. I have a couple other notes for myself, but the I think there was a question that Commissioner Christman also had about the extension of amortization schedule and how that will subsequently impacts the rates to customers. Commissioner Fedorchuk had questions about transmission level, essentially whether that's a MISO tariff rate, how that applies to MISO tariff rates, and how that works within, I guess, the MISO system, as well as just a closer look at the costs associated with the MISO rates. We generally discussed that there were quite a few fairly large capital expenditures in a lot of different areas, from relocation of buildings and so forth. And advocacy staff, I know, will do a dig into all that and took a pretty close look at that. And maybe a subsequent and more generalized informational filing to the commissioners discussing utility depreciation versus tax depreciation, book depreciation, and an explanation of, I guess, how that generally kind of applies in a rate case in a more of a summarized version. So just to refresh ourselves prior to this rate case. Mm-hmm. Did I miss anything?
We talked a little bit about labor, the replacement of the 13 positions in the outage management system.
Sure.
Wanting more clarification on that. And when we look at attachment 3 under labor and benefits, there's quite a bit of variance in some stuff. To look at that. And
is there a specific type of clarification you're looking for?
Well, when I look under labor, I don't know what this is incentive comp, ACCR, we have a variance of 86.02%. What is that, Adam? Do you?
If I had to guess, that would be, that is what, that's their bone, or that's might be executive compensation, maybe.
Well, above that they have bonuses and commissions, and that's an increase of 37.51%.
Yeah.
So I mean, some of that, I would like to dig into a little bit more.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit under the benefits, this pension expense. We see quite a bit of decrease, and then we see post-retirement, that's up almost 250%.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are other benefits, which has, you know, some of that, just looking, I understand workers' comp, you know, increase some of that. But there's quite a bit of variance under labor and benefits take a look at.
Yeah. And pension is a pretty difficult animal to think about. It involves actuarial concepts. It has a smoothing technique through time. So it's
and
not the
that's
easiest.
Exciting, reading an actuary report there.
Yeah.
No.
What's that?
I said that's exciting, reading that report.
Yeah.
Actuarial. Said no commissioner.
No simple answer.
Go ahead, Randy.
Were you done on that?
Yep.
And then also just some kind of discussion about what is the proper revenue to cost ratio on residential. I mean, certainly with just the interveners involved here, we're going to have some saying, well, everybody should pay their right share. And you'll have others saying, well, look at all these other states and how low their residential is. And you know, states don't necessarily compare. I can see where our residential gets, for our culture, gets higher priced than if you stack everybody on top of one another in apartment buildings.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what we should be really shooting for. We've hopefully made progress over the years. I don't know what's proper, and I don't have a good reason for the 0.88.
Sure. And then also the rationale for the sales decline.
Yeah.
And then...
And line growth.
And line growth. And then the Big Stone environmental upgrades and whether we approve that or, you know, the history behind it.
And just to give you a general sense of what we'll anticipate from the interveners, I think you know what ARP usually brings forward. It's usually just a rate design argument. Once in a while, they get a little deeper in the class cost service study as well. The Walmart usually brings forward just a very brief return in class costs. Well, they go into class cost of service. That's a big issue for them too. But they also usually provide an ROE expert on that one as well. At least some testimony related to it, even though it has been fairly generalized in the past. And I'm presuming Marathon will be looking at more extensively the class cost of service as well, but I'm not sure how that necessarily applies. I hadn't really thought about that with their contract rates, because I'm assuming they have a contract rate as well, right?
That I don't know.
Okay, we'll look into that too and get you a little more information about the contract rates the Marathon currently has. And Adam, will you be writing up the summary of these items?
Yeah.
Okay.
Randy, do you have anything else?
Maybe not.
Okay. You guys clear on everything? And obviously, some of this is for advocacy staff to be thinking about and exploring as well. So all these things don't fall on you.
Yeah, except for the couple action items that we probably have as advisory staff. This will mostly be a list provided to advocacy staff as they move forward with this.
Perfect.
Good.
Okay. That... That was a good discussion. Thank you, everybody. That concludes our work session on case number 22194.